Peter B. Collins. News and comment for Wednesday, July 23rd, 2014.
It's late in the evening, lost on the side. I've been sad with you for most of the night.
I don't know if you listen late in the evening, early in the morning, while you're commuting. I know one person who listens while she's fixing dinner every night. One of the songs and artists breaking out on my personal hit parade this summer. A British artist named Ed Sheeran. This song is called Sing, and he's got a string of hits. Very popular with the young ladies, from what I can glean.
If you're lonely, come on, get involved. Feel it rushing through you from your head to toe.
And down to the dirty business of news and comment. Our blowhard Secretary of State, John Kerry, shuttled himself from Cairo, Egypt, into Israel and is planning to visit the West Bank today. He's working on some shuttle diplomacy, and unfortunately, the United States has very little credibility and, frankly, less leverage than it has in the past over the warring factions, Israel and Hamas. And while I hope the secretary is able to cobble something together, I'd love to see the violence suspended. The United States is going about it ass backwards. What's your favorite way to put that? I mean, first he goes to Egypt. And since the military coup there last July 3rd that we still don't call a coup, Field Marshal al-Sisi has become the new Mubarak, the military dictator of that country. He's a big opponent of Hamas. He's closed some of the tunnels along the Egyptian border. And so the U.S. once again shows its bias, trying to ram a deal down the throats of the Hamas leaders that has been agreed to by Egypt and Israel. Well, that's a non-starter. And I think Hamas, which is a highly imperfect organization, I have a lot of differences with what Hamas does. My solidarity is with the aspirations of the Palestinian people. And Hamas is often in conflict with those aspirations. But it's an interesting shift that Mahmoud Abbas, the leader of the Fatah faction of the Palestinians, who last week had at least temporarily backed the Egyptian proposal for a ceasefire, signaled today that he is now unifying with Hamas. And he announced that the demands of Hamas, including opening the border crossings into Egypt and Israel, easing the restrictions on farming, fishing, imports, and exports, and releasing prisoners who were recently rearrested by Israel, well, Fatah is now supporting those demands. The statement reads, "The demands of Gaza to end the aggression and lift the blockade are the demands of the entire Palestinian people." And all too often, Israel's divide and conquer strategy is effective in dividing these two key factions of the Palestinians. And it's interesting, as we told yesterday, and you've certainly heard it elsewhere, many airlines suspended flights to Tel Aviv because a Hamas rocket came within a mile or so of the Ben-Gurion airport yesterday. And it's really interesting to see the reaction. Michael Bloomberg, the billionaire former mayor of New York, who typically flies to Israel on his private jet, in a show of his solidarity, he flew commercial. He flew into Ben-Gurion on El Al. Bloomberg said, well, it's the most protected airport in the world. And this is fascinating because we've just seen nearly 300 people perish as an airliner was shot down as it flew over a war zone. And Israel is saying, don't cancel flights to Tel Aviv accept the risk that your commercial airliner might be hit by a rocket from Hamas. Now, Hamas has not used any surface-to-air missiles so far, but they might have them. And yet, Israel is more concerned about its image, more concerned about not handing some perceived advantage to Hamas in its psychological war, and it wants mostly Jews to make themselves or to put themselves at risk of becoming sacrificial lambs in order to maintain the arrogance of the Israeli government. I find that fascinating and equally troubling. There are a couple of analytical pieces published in today's New York Times. Both have interesting points, and I found flaws in each of them. Anne Bernard, Dateline Gaza City, speculates on Hamas and that they basically decided they had nothing to lose. And so they gambled that it could shift the balance with arms and militants. And the article erroneously states that the starting point of this conflict was when Hamas sent a barrage of rockets into Israel. Simmering hostilities and back-and-forth strikes erupted into war. This is the selective view, the frame, that America's corporate media, as it tilts toward Israel, continues to present. And as I have argued, the origins of this conflict are Israel's bitter opposition to Hamas. Israel tanked the John Kerry peace talks. Then it objected to the unity government of Hamas and Fatah. Then it seized on the pretext of the three missing, then kidnapped, then dead teenagers. And we know from Max Blumenthal the 18 days that Netanyahu and his fellow leaders of Israel knew that those three teens were dead, yet they stoked the hysteria. That led to the revenge killings of Palestinian youths. And all of this preceded the Hamas unleashing of rockets into Israel. But that is conveniently excised from the framing of these stories. So Bernard writes, this conflict has demonstrated that while Hamas governed over 1.7 million people mired in poverty, its leaders were pouring resources into its military and expanding its ability to fight Israel. I think that's a fair statement. It seems that the focus of Hamas the last few years has been on this tunnel system, and that has come at the expense of the quality of life for people in Gaza. Abdullah Al-Aryan, professor at Georgetown, is quoted, there were low expectations in terms of its performance against the recent round of Israeli incursions. Hamas has been exceeding all expectations, and it's likely to come out in a far better position than in the last 3 years, maybe the last decade. And the article recaps how allies like Syria and Egypt under the new military dictatorship no longer support Hamas. It's more isolated than it has been. And so it's going to be very interesting to see how these frames, how these perceptions play out over the coming days and weeks. The death count now is at least 620 Palestinians killed, 100 of those children, estimated 75% of them civilians, and some 27 Israeli soldiers, two of their civilians reported dead so far. The other think piece, written with a Washington dateline by Peter Baker, does a decent job of explaining the complex challenges faced by President Obama right now. He writes, rarely has a president been confronted with so many seemingly disparate foreign policy crises all at once. Ukraine, Israel, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, elsewhere. But making the current upheaval more complicated for Obama is the seemingly interlocking nature of them all. And I referred to this in some respects yesterday. Baker, the cross currents can be dizzying. Even as Mr. Obama presses Russia to stop fomenting a virtual civil war in Ukraine, he's trying to collaborate with Moscow in a diplomatic campaign to force Iran to scale back its nuclear program. Even as he pressures Iran, he finds himself on the same side as Tehran in combating a rising Sunni insurgency in Iraq. Even as he sends special forces to help squelch those insurgents, he is trying to help their putative allies against the government in Syria next door. Yeah, we've got a series of lose-lose propositions that Obama is confronting. Regarding Gaza, Baker says while backing Israel's right to defend itself against Hamas rockets, he sent Kerry to work with Egypt to force a ceasefire. This is the same Egypt to which Obama cut financial aid for a time because its leaders came to power after the military overthrew the Morsi government. Well, he slapped Egypt on the wrist, and now they're best buds. They're our allies trying to fight for peace, trying to struggle to bring an end to this conflict. And as I've pointed out, we have yet to criticize Egypt for its draconian mass trials of individuals who were sentenced to death in trials that last less than 20 minutes. Hundreds of people sentenced en masse. And the recent lengthy sentences for Al Jazeera journalists. We haven't heard any official protest coming from Washington to Cairo. And I predict that we won't bring them up because the perception is that we need Egypt. But Egypt is now seen as a staunch ally of Israel, and this is another way where the U.S. doesn't have credibility, doesn't have traction. And it's interesting, domestically, Obama is losing ground in public opinion polls. 58% of Americans in a recent New York Times CBS poll disapproved of his handling of world affairs, a 10% jump in a month. But there are no good choices. And I can't believe that all those 58% think that he should have become militarily involved in Syria, should have bombed Russia over the Ukraine incidents. I mean, he doesn't have a lot of good options. There's no doubt about that. And this article quotes Ben Rhodes, the Deputy National Security Advisor at the White House. Just because there are a lot of global challenges doesn't mean you have to overreact on one just to make a point. I think he's speaking to John McCain there. And Rhodes was interviewed earlier this week on the Public Television News Hour by Gwen Ifill, and my jaw dropped because they were talking about Ukraine, and her response was to say, well, who should the U.S. send arms to? Huh? I found that utterly bizarre. An Associated Press story offers a little bit of balance. Headline, for many Gazans, blockade is the key to any truce deal. And I think this article, for the most part, fairly represents the interests of average Palestinians. They profile a guy named Ibrahim Zain, who was driven from his home by Israeli tank fire this week. He says he'd rather endure more Israel-Hamas fighting than accept an unconditional ceasefire he fears will leave in place the blockade of the Gaza Strip. Like Zain, many Gaza residents say the closure imposed by Israel and Egypt after Hamas seized Gaza in 2007 is like a slow death. We want a good life or no life, said the 44-year-old father of nine, Mr. Zain. The article notes that in a way, it's emerging as the Gazan equivalent of what is single-mindedly driving the Israelis, the rocket fire from Gaza, which they feel must stop at almost any cost. For the Gazans, it's the blockade that must stop at almost any cost, and it seems that that cost is being extracted. The United Nations is investigating whether Israel may have committed war crimes in this recent launch of hostilities against Gaza. According to Navi Pillay, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, there seems to be a strong possibility that international law has been violated in a manner that could amount to war crimes. Some observers say a child has been killed every hour on average in the past 2 days. Officials say more than 3,000 homes have been destroyed or damaged, 46 schools, 56 mosques, and 7 hospitals have been hit. That, of course, is the precision attacks that Israel claims it is so careful with. And, as required, Pillay also condemned Hamas and other militant groups for their indiscriminate attacks on Israel. A resolution has called for the urgent dispatch of an independent international commission of inquiry to investigate violations of international human rights and humanitarian law. I want to pause here to thank the people who support my work at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. I mentioned the other day Teresa Jimenez is a new subscriber with an annual subscription. Thank you, Teresa. And monthly subscribers who continue to support me include Bernice Del Orto, Diane Morris, and Aaron Blair. Thank you, one and all. And I want to use this opportunity to invite you, the listener who enjoys this podcast but isn't a subscriber, to reach for your wallet and say, "Can I help Peter B?" And if the answer is yes, then come on over, peterbcollins.com. The link is under my picture. It says sign up. That takes you to a page where you choose $5, $10, $20 a month. Our best deal is the $50 annual subscription, and new annual subscribers in the U.S. will get a copy of John Dist's Red Flag CD, and if I still have some, a bag of kick-ass Kona coffee beans supplied by Russ Archibald on the Big Island of Hawaii. Well, I mentioned Ukraine and the shoot down of the Malaysian airliner last week. And there isn't any real new valuable speculation on who caused that. But today, fighting intensified in East Ukraine, with military officials reporting that 2 Ukrainian fighter jets have been shot down near the village of Dmitrovka. Sorry, my Russian is weak. Few details available, but government troops claim they have retaken 2 cities in the Luhansk region in the last 2 days. But rebels have blown up a bridge, a railroad bridge, train tracks in the city of Gorlivka, and reported continuing fierce fighting along a section of the border with Russia. So that conflict continues on a very intense basis. And so does the war in Afghanistan, but it is largely off the pages of American newspapers. These days, events in Afghanistan get reduced to little 1 or 2 paragraph squibs, which presumes to reflect the lack of interest of America's editors and perhaps the readers as well. And I commend Al Jazeera America and its reporter Matthew Akins for a great enterprise story coming from Afghanistan. And it opens with the scene on June 1st of this year in a small town where special forces and Afghan army commandos arrived by helicopter. That's U.S. special forces. They went to the town of Alazai, a farming hamlet in Andar district of central Afghanistan, and they did a night raid, arresting any fighting-age men. They rounded them up, put them in a courtyard. And later that day, a local warlord, who has no official role, arrived with a group of guys on motorcycles. They went into the town, and they grabbed 3 men, blindfolded them, put them on their motorcycles, took them outside of town, and then shot them dead with more than 100 rounds. Now, this is just one example that is offered, that the U.S. is so focused on its exit strategy that we are allowing these rogue officials to operate. And here we have U.S. troops that are supposed to be the adult minders for Afghan troops. But this warlord, who is part of a program that the U.S. has called ALP, let's see if I can grab what that acronym stands for. The ALP program, under which local militias would be trained by U.S. Special Forces and placed under the command of the Afghan Ministry of the Interior. The only problem is that we don't seem to have very good controls over who we deputize in this ALP program. There's much more to the story. I will link to it in the show file for this podcast and encourage you to read it because I don't expect that it's going to show up in corporate media in this country anytime soon. President Obama dispatched his chief of staff, Dennis McDonough, and a senior counterterrorism advisor to Germany this week, meeting with counterparts there to try to repair relations that have been bruised because we were spying on Angela Merkel's own cell phone and, more recently, two German intelligence employees were compromised by our CIA, and that became public. Now, Germany would like a no-spy agreement. They'd like to agree we won't spy on you and you won't spy on us. But the U.S. has made it clear that we're not going to elevate Germany to the level of our five allies, the so-called Five Eyes. Britain, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, together with the U.S., make the Five Eyes. And this article in The Guardian is interesting. Part of the problem, it says, was that Germany, which doesn't have surveillance capabilities equivalent to those of Five Eye countries, didn't have much to offer the U.S. But hey, if it's a no-spy agreement, you don't have to offer anything, right? That's a little incoherent in my view. The controversy over the CIA informants appears to have been a turning point. The Germans now hope the negotiation between the two countries will yield a new set of principles that will guide future intelligence operations. And the White House issued this statement. The full range of issues was addressed, including intelligence and security matters. McDonough and the other guy named Altmaier agreed to set up a structured dialogue to address concerns of both sides and establish guiding principles as the basis for continued and future cooperation. Okay. So they're agreeing to use a process to just try to bury this whole issue. We reported earlier this week on the conviction in Boston of a friend of Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, who was accused of obstruction of justice. That was a guy named Azamat Tajayakov. And now there is today the announcement of another friend of Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, Stephen Silva, has been placed under arrest. And they've got two different raps on him. One is they accuse him of dealing heroin in the recent past. That's not related to the Boston Marathon bombing case. But they're also saying that he supplied a 9mm Ruger pistol with the identifying marks shaved off to the Tsarnaev brothers, and here's what is fascinating. The indictment doesn't say, but the news accounts are reporting that this 9mm Ruger pistol was used in the killing of MIT campus cop Sean Collier. And as you have heard us discuss on this program and with Russ Baker from whowhatwhy.com, the website that has done the best coverage of the clear cover-up. We don't know what they're covering up, but boy, is the government covering up on the investigation. And this latest indictment of this guy Silva is part of the drip, drip, drip leading up to the November trial scheduled for Dzhokhar Tsarnaev. It's being tried in the media. They're building their case against Tsarnaev publicly. And as you know, there are, I hope you know, and if you don't, go back and Google Russ Baker or search, put it in the search window at peterbcollins.com. And look for my recent interview with Russ. We've done three or four over the past year about the Boston Marathon bombing. And the FBI cannot be trusted on this case. The government can't be trusted. The killing of Totashev in Florida, another friend of the Tsarnaev brothers is still unexplained, even though they've exonerated the FBI agent who had a violent past as an Oakland Police Department officer. And those are just some of the threads of this very murky case coming out of Boston. And we will continue to try to bring you the important issues here, raise skeptical questions, and point out where it appears the government is trying to cover things up. Here in the Bay Area, we've had some traffic jams and the other natural consequences of a presidential visit. And Obama didn't come here to sign new legislation or help California in any way. He came to raid our campaign ATM. Held a fundraiser, actually a couple of them, in the Bay Area. One in San Francisco, one in Silicon Valley. They're trying to raise $1 million for the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. And because of all the crises that I referred to earlier, this, you know, business-as-usual approach by Obama makes him a target for Republican catcalls. What's he doing raising money when the world's on fire? And I also have to add that while I'd love to see Democrats regain control of the House, they can pour millions of dollars into that, but the gerrymandering the Democrats failed to challenge. And this all goes back to after 2008, when Obama won, Democrats relaxed. And in 2010, we took it on the chin, and I'm not a member of the Democratic Party, I shouldn't say we, but I identify with Democrats more than Republicans. And Democrats really just allowed the massive takeover of state legislatures and governorships by Republicans. Then the scheduled census and redistricting took place. Because of that gerrymandering, I don't see mathematically how it's possible for Democrats to regain control of the House, no matter how much money Obama helps them raise. Interesting article in Sunday's New York Times, and I'm just getting to it now because of the rush of other news. It shows that there's a new way that the banksters are exploiting poor and stupid people in this country. We had the subprime housing mortgage scandal, where the banksters packaged the toxic loans with healthy loans and nearly brought down our entire economic system. And of course, no one's really been held accountable for that. They didn't even require them to cough up the bonuses and commissions that they earned for writing bad loans. Well, now the focus is subprime auto lenders who loan money to people who buy used cars at exorbitant interest rates and with a very high rate of foreclosure. Auto loans, subprime auto loans, increased roughly 15% in the first 3 months of this year to $145.6 billion. That's a lot of money on the street chasing people who are likely to be unable to repay those loans. And it's really sad. I mean, I like to see people get access to credit if they can afford to pay it back. But this is predatory lending. And whether it's payday loans or subprime auto loans, our government, our leaders, often turn a blind eye to the exploitation of the poorest, most vulnerable among us. And finally, today there's a struggle in Portland, Oregon, which has been rated as one of the least religious communities in the country. A group of evangelicals calling themselves the Child Evangelism Fellowship's Good News Club, that's quite a name, has started hosting events in public parks where they try to convert children as young as age 5. This has produced an opposing group called Protect Portland Children, and Kay Schmidt, an organizer, is quoted as saying, "They pretend to be a mainstream Christian Bible study when in fact they're a very old-school fundamentalist sect." And this Associated Press story also quotes a local self-identified Christian, Mia Marceau, mother of two, who was initially intrigued when the group approached her at her apartment complex last week. She says she believes in Jesus Christ. Within a few hours, however, she didn't like what the group was telling her 8-year-old son and his friends. That they were going to hell, they needed to convert their friends, and they were duty-bound to raise money for the Bible Thumpers. Country Joe, can you give us a little rendition of that Holy Roller?
I used to expose myself to people out on the streets. Now when I feel the urge to sin, I just fall down on my knees. And I sing,
Holy Roller, roll one time for me. Holy Roller, roll one time for me. Holy Roller, roll one time for me.
Well, hallelujah, my friends, by the sin on snow white wings, in the choir I'll sing, the heavenly host, ain't no joke, cause religion has set me free.
Yeah, he sings, religion has set me free, goddamn. Thanks for listening. I'm still Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.